All right. Are we all in? Are you guys in? Coming? Just passing by? Okay, let's just come back, right? Let's come back from this. So to sit back in our breath, to find our way to our breath, let's just begin with a tall seat. And a tall seat, you know, here we're in sort of the mechanics of breathing. A tall seat has a heavy bottom. We're anchored, we're heavy, like there's a weight sitting in our seat, in our feet. And if you let your bottom, your seat, be very, very heavy, you might notice that there's a response, which is a rebounding energy, which is a lift of the heart. So press down and feel a rise up, lift the heart, and let the collarbones spread and the shoulders just fall behind you. You may notice that when you get this two-directional lift, that the belly is then free to move. It's like a balloon. And we can't go to sleep with this seat. We have to stay with it. There's muscular energy. There's a action in holding ourselves up, this rebounding lift. So lift through the back of the skull. It lengthens the back of the neck. The chin will tuck slightly. And again, descend through your seat into the ground. In the middle is softness. The belly moves softly. Soften the muscles of the face. One thing to note here on today's theme is what our body knows is learned through and past the body to the heart, to the soul. So here we have what would seem opposites being reconciled. Muscular energy, we're holding ourselves up, we're supporting ourselves. There's a lift, we need our belly muscles. And then at the very same moment, there's softness, soften the face, belly soft like a balloon. So this is a reconciliation of opposites, two extremes, two opposites happening together harmoniously. And now we can further connect by extending the exhale. So at the end of the exhale, just extend it out a little further in front of you. And then the inhale starts to be desired, right? When we really empty out, you can feel a little bit of need, a little bit of desire, and then let the inhale come in. Belly soft, belly rises, and let the inhale fill you a little more than you normally would. Let it fill you to the top. Sip a little bit of air in, and then maybe pause, hold the breath, just for a second or two. Throat open, relaxed. On the top of this inhale, you can feel a kind of hovering. And then when the breath must come, then we exhale, empty out. And again, extend the breath. Each time at the end of the exhale, go a little further, and we can add to that the imagination, right? The Sufi path is one of imaginal adornment. So send the breath far and wide. Send it past the door of the room, out the lawn, send it up into the atmosphere. And again, lure the breath to you, pull it from Venus, pull it from the sun, and see it find its way to you, knowing that the breath knows no boundary. Everything on some microscopic level is porous. This breath knows no inside, no outside. It just moves through. And when it reaches the body on the inhale, let it reach, let it touch every single cell. So this is not the imagination. Every breath reaches every cell of your being, always bringing oxygenated breath, essentially bringing life. There's no part not reached. Teeth, bone, the back of the eyeballs, under the kneecaps, between the ligaments and joints, teeth, throat. And again, this is called boxed breathing, extending the exhale out, making it longer each time, pushing the last bits of air out, feeling the little moment of longing that follows that, where we must have the breath, we want the breath. And then taking the breath back in and letting it reach everywhere, keeping at the same time an awareness that the body as a container needs some muscular strength. We're tall, we have a lifted seat, our belly muscles need to engage to hold up the spine, and yet there's softness, the belly, the muscles of the face. Noticing another aspect of this breath. At the end of the exhale, after emptying out and then emptying out a little further still, there's a turn and there's a cliff. We can't really follow it all the way. It's where the breath dissolves and the one who the breath rides on, the current that brings the breath, the part that's imperceivable, our most intimate window for the one who brings the breath, sits there. And when the inhale comes now, it's like a gulp. We have that little bit of desire from emptying out so completely, we can add to this that we're essentially receiving the gift that is there in every breath, always, unnoticed usually. Without which there is no life. So before we open our eyes, as you sit in this swing of the breath, stay with it, come back, remember, empty all the way. Send the breath far and wide. Lure the breath back to you. Know that it travels. And then let it reach you everywhere with every inhale all at once. So before we open the eyes, remember to remember, as the Sufis say, come back to the breath. And when we open the eyes, remember you can stay home. Mostly, we don't have to throw ourselves out through our eyes and lose our interior. So when we establish the breath, we have a rhythm. And then the question is, can we keep this rhythm? Can we take it with us and let it be our guide as we travel forward? So let the eyes float open, but see how it feels to sit back and stay mostly at home. So from this position, we're less caught up in the drama, less pulled by the energy of others, and always the breath is its home base. This is where we live. If we lose this, who knows? This is where we live. This is our home. So the theme for today is guidance. And as I thought about that theme when I was asked to teach it, what occurred to me is we're Sufis. We come from a unified perspective. There's only one guidance. There's only one teacher. So in our greatest hopes, the best we can do if we're so super successful is make a situation so that what you walk away with is something I don't know, even though I'm the teacher, because I'm not the teacher. I could point, and I could like throw out some mapping and hints, And then, you know, there are practices and they have forms and ways. But I felt there's no point in starting out on a conversation about guidance without at least earmarking that everything we do is just stuff we make up. Even the practices that have survived hundreds of years, they must point to something living. At best, if we're successful, in a lifetime, we make a container, a space, so that the one who is the only guide can come. So Ishkala Mabudala, one of the paradoxical phrases that we use as contemplative practice, is also to say, I am the guide, the guided, and guidance. In a unified reality of the Sufi, guidance is everywhere. It's never not been before us, in us, around us. And so the question about guidance really becomes, like, what to do? How do I accept a bounty that is everywhere, always, and coming from within, and notice it? Notice essentially what is hidden in plain sight. It's so evident that we can't see it. We don't notice it. And Murshid points to this many, many times over. I grabbed this one quote. In the calm, pure depths of one's own heart, there is a fountain of truth, love, and understanding, a wondrous flow of supreme guidance, which is far greater than anything the logical, rational mind has to offer. Only the heart can understand that which the head has been overlooking. In the calm, pure depths of one's heart, there is a fountain of truth, love, and understanding, a wondrous flow of supreme guidance in the fountain of our hearts, right here, which is greater than anything the logical, rational mind has to offer. Only the heart can understand. As Sufis, we know, I mean, this is our path, this is the path of the heart. It's a tip that we have to somehow move from here to here, to notice what's already evident, what's already everywhere. If you've been on retreat, you know, we sensitize ourselves with Sufi practices and retreat, and often, you know, you go out into nature and all of a sudden you look at a leaf. You know, I guide retreats, and on day two, usually retreatants are coming over to me with like little piles of leaves and things and saying, do you see it? Right? So the guidance is that's always there, somehow was able to speak. I remember on a recent retreat that I was leading, I'm on retreat when I'm leading a retreat. You can't get off retreat. Once retreat's on, it's game on, right, for everybody. I took a run in the afternoon, and I'm running down this road, and often my feeling of absence, poor me, in my own spiritual work and growth and development, has the tone of there's never been enough help. I haven't had enough help. Right, so that's my thing that I have to work on. And here I am saying, guidance is everywhere. So the fault is the container, the globe over the heart, me. So I'm jogging down the road. It's never enough help. And this dog, who drove by on a pickup truck a minute earlier, pops up from the side of the road and runs in front of me. And he's like, I like to run too. And there's me and the dog running down the road. And then he dips off into a ditch, and then a half mile down the road, he pops up again, and up by the cemetery, he pops up again, and he's hanging out with me at the cemetery. And this dog just keeps appearing and appearing and appearing and appearing, and eventually I said, oh, I get it. You know, it's a leaf. Can you see it? This dog is telling me, you know, I'm here. I'm still here. And I'm here too, and I'm there, and I'm here, and I'm there, and I'm there. And of course, when we're on retreat, we're uniquely tuned to know that that was the message. Once you pinpoint it, there's a big yes. Oh yeah, that's definitely what he meant. So, the question becomes how to make this accessible. What do we do to make ourselves porous enough to recognize guidance and receive it? A place we can begin contemplative practice is our way, and a contemplative question we can sit with for a moment is, what if? What if your whole life has been guided? What if never an instant were you without this guidance? What if? So often when we take that question in, you know, the ego throws up a whole bunch of stuff like, well, what about that time that I was utterly left out? And what about that time they took my room away? What about? And we throw up a bunch of stories about all the times we felt like guidance wasn't there. And for the Sufi, the way we live is really in multiple worlds. We decide what our memories are. You just have to play a game of telephone once to know how faulty the memory is. It's pliable, it's completely like clay. It changes, you know, instantaneously, which is true, probably all of them, sort of. I wrote a book, I'm tempted to write it 6 times over, same stories, but totally different books, and they all be true, just to see how far can you push this exercise. What's true is what we hold in our hearts. This is the only thing that affects our lives. You wake up in the morning and what's here is true. It is the thing that shapes the next behavior, your reaction, your response, how you live in the world. And the Sufi say that our unique path helps us to see the loss and the gain, the pleasure and the pain, the right and the wrong. Right? We don't live in a duality. We live in a unity that became a multiplicity, but essentially a unity. If you get far enough away from pain, it changes. Pain up front with your face pressed against material reality really hurts. But a step back from body and mind to heart, and it might really just feel like a tap. Like, hey, are you up? Or like a psychic pressure. Something's got to give. Something's got to change. It's not really pain. It's really just an alert. And then maybe from even a wider view, closer to unity, from the view of the soul, we say pain becomes majesty and beauty, pleasure and pain. So one exercise, and we can take a moment and do this together, is to reflect upon the stories that come up when we say, what if every instant of my life was guided? What story sits there as evidence that, well, maybe not this time? So let's just close the eyes for a moment and again come back to a tall seat. So the breath can be our guide, our aid in this process. So let the breath move. The breath is so telling. When we especially reflect on a memory, and maybe a memory that has a little bit of thorn in it, when the breath stops, when the breath pauses, the first thing we do is hold our breath when we're upset, when we're angry, when we lose our center. So see if you can find a story, and then watch that story for a moment. Keep this rhythm of the breath, a tall seat, a soft belly, a soft face. See if you can bring the story forward. And now just put the story aside. You've earmarked it. It's like you put a little thumbtack and we're going to just put it aside for a moment and go deeper back into your imagination and consider for a moment that as human beings, our first year of life, unlike other animals that just get up and run and start to hunt for their food, as human beings, our first year of life is utterly dependent. We are dependent on dozens, if not hundreds, of people. If not for our mother, of course, as the first. And maybe, you know, some people start out without even that one in their life, but still behind that is the ones who raise us, the ones who feed us. And still past this is the ones who grow food and drive trucks that deliver it, and the photosynthesis of the sun. All of these have been guides. All of these have been behind their face, the guidance that is behind all. When we look at our food in the ground, there's worms, there's insects, there's photosynthesis, there's evaporation, there's rain, there's a nuclear furnace in the sky that provides the light and the heat, our nourishment, guidance through every face. And then because we were so well guided, we were able to grow up. And not just grow up, but be so privileged that we're sitting here. Not to mention that we have a teacher, or dozens, multiple teachers, but that we should be able to afford to be here, healthy enough to get here. So guidance, we can see, has been everywhere. But now let's take our story back and come back to the story that you identified, where maybe it seemed guidance was absent. And take a look at all the characters, if there are characters. And recognize that every character in your story, you're a character in their story, they're a character in other people's story. And we have overlapping, like a cascade, of the one living out essentially all these stories, which is a bunch of us all doing the same thing, which is trying to normalize being the first of our kind, trying to normalize being different. And it's messy because we live embodied and in matter. You know, the baseball player Yogi Berra said, if the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. This is why we're here, this mess. To normalize being unique, there's no other you. And then to see the way the stories slam into each other, it's messy. It's a process. So with that, let's step widen our lens yet one step more and look back on this story with all these characters and all these situations and with this understanding that there is only one life being lived, one heart. And dig through the story and see, was there something I gained from this? Did it shape me a new way? Did it make me see differently? Did it give me an unexpected skill or perspective, strength? Did it push me to understand something? Did it make me more compassionate? Did I just have to let go? So in the struggle, in the pain, often if we look with our heart tuned to look. We can see the gain in the loss, the pleasure in the pain, the gift, the reward for what felt at the moment like a prick. And see that even in the darkest of moments, guidance is there. We have to also accept that sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes we can't just say, well, I want to reflect on this and it's going to all be better because I did, right? Defenses have their reasons. So as you sit with this, you know, it's presumptuous to expect the one to fix things in a snap just because you're ready, right? But we can breathe into it. And know that we've touched on it, we've opened it up, we've invited a new perspective. So let's take Yahadi, the Wazifa Yahadi, and we'll just maybe do 7 times and blow the words directly into the heart. Yahadi brings balance. Yahadi is awakening to guidance. It's recognizing the guidance that's there. And with that is always a letting in, right? So what do we do to let something in? So we don't just say it, you know, and then open our eyes and, you know, say, I went to class, you know. We can be porous. We can let ourselves be, again, like the screen door that our breath knows we are. It knows no boundary. Every inhale, every exhale, we feel it on the lip, but really this breath is moving through bone and blood and clothes and shoes and tissue effortlessly. So being porous to Hadi, let guidance in from everywhere, from behind you, in front of you, below your feet. Let's whisper it 7 times into the heart. Yahadi. 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 Let's do the one layer deeper, closer to the soul, away from the world, and do Yahadi 7 times silently in the heart. And then just take a moment and release Yahadi and feel the spaciousness left behind, the quality left behind. The Sufis remember like an art form, the art of remembering. We live the story that we hold in our heart. We can go back to all the stories. We use so often the image of the globe over the heart and blow away the obstruction. Essentially, so guidance, the light within, can just be made evident. It's been there all along. Rumi said, if it's bread that you seek, you will have bread. If it's the soul you seek, you'll find the soul. And if you understand this secret, you know that you are that which you seek. So I can carry on my back my disgruntledness, you know, my perturbance with the world, or I can carry on my back Yahadi, or Salam, or the bright side. I used to tell a story. I wasn't going to tell the story, but since the morning was so much about the body, you know, my whole life I had this story of my birth, which is a true story. I was adopted, and my genetic grandfather was an abusive person, and he essentially beat my genetic mother into labor with me. And it's a terrible story, I know. Sorry, it's a little harsh. But so most of my life, I really carried this story with a sentiment of poor me. So I came out, and my parents adopted me, and they took me to the doctor and said, something's not right here, and I went into a body cast for 2.5 years. And poor me, poor me. I carried this story, poor me, poor me. And then, as a Sufi, I realized that it's my responsibility how this, what I carry. And I realized from this very practice, lucky me, my parents adopted me. My genetic parents could never have afforded that surgery, never. Somebody took me and said, we're going to change this fate. I was probably held more than any baby, any other baby. I couldn't crawl. No one would probably ever yelled at me because I didn't crawl and I didn't get into things. It was just there. And they were always picking me up, picking me up. I was close to everyone's heart. I was constantly held. I was embraced, 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 embraced. So lucky me. And I came on that practice in my early 30s when my hip, which was the main injury in that birth process, failed. And I was in the hospital and I couldn't walk. And the doctor said, in the morning, we're going to take this hip. And I said, I'm not going to let you. And I left on crutches. And I was in Austin, Texas, traveling. I was on a road trip alone. And I begged, you know, and I said, let me keep this hip. Let me please keep this. Let me keep this hip. And this was before yoga was common, and you had to, like, find a yoga teacher. And I didn't know what yoga was. And I woke up every day, couldn't walk, alone on the road, and I started praying, let me keep this hip. And I listened, and I intuited all these movements and breaths, and I did all these things, and in a week I was walking. And a few months later, learned that what I was doing was yoga. I compared the movements, and I looked at the pictures, and I was like, I know yoga. You know, like, it came from within. It's guidance. Guidance said, and surely I realized, oh, well, this is how yoga got here. Someone like me needed the movement and discovered it. It's here all the time. But I tuned myself, and I asked for help, and then I listened, and then I did it. And that was about 15 years ago. And now I'm a runner. So attached to that was, wow, my gratitude. So I promised I'm going to become a yogi, a yoga teacher, and then I learned yoga officially, but I already knew it. And I made a pledge, because when guidance gives, you don't hoard it and say, this is just for me. Because it's the one, giving to the one. So my pledge that day was, any time this is needed, I don't care what I'm doing, yes, I'll teach yoga. Whatever you want to pay, whatever. Yes, yes. It's not my gift to hoard. And that points, you know, to our relationship with the one, which is reciprocity. We're not a dead end for guidance. When guidance comes, it's like a hot potato. What can I do with this guidance? Yeah, okay, I take the benefit, it was given, but then what? I'll give you one other story, the story I meant to tell, but the body overwhelmed me. I used to be in marketing, and I was very good at it, and I realized I wasn't really changing the world in any good way. You know, I was just making famous people more famous and helping people sell widgets, and it was pretty empty. So I quit. And when I quit, a Sufi at the time, I said, let me produce with these skills. Let me make one gift. Let me make a Band-Aid, a remedy for materialism, something. And I meditated on it, meditated on it, and I decided to write a grant for whatever it would be, so to give it a vessel to pour into, guidance. And I wound up creating a mechanism for textile repurposing that is a model, and I put it in the world. And I knew when I got the idea, when it downloaded, I knew, like, I can never take credit for this. This was not me. It just came. So I put it in the world, and you know, in my career, you know, getting things to work is so hard. It's like pushing rocks up a hill, right, to market a new idea and get the media to pay attention. My job was hard. But this idea, same skill set, applied to this, let me give a remedy. I put it in the world, and the first event, 500 people came. Within a year, it was in 25 cities. It jumped to 135 cities. It's in Istanbul. It's in Panama. It's in Vienna. I never promoted it. I never did anything except produce the one. And its magnetism was so big that it just went like this. And sure enough, corporations came. They wanted to greenwash their work with my credibility, this green event. It's this, you know, all sustainability. It had this wonderful reputation. And PG&E, San Francisco's power company, said, here's $100,000. Can we put our logo on it? Hell no. Hell no. It's not mine, right? This is, you don't take guidance, right? So, and looking at them, I said, you don't have anything I need. I already went to 135 cities without you. Guidance. You know, do you hitch your boat to the one, the real, or to the artificial, the mimic, the apparatus? So, again, though, reciprocity. I gave it as a gift to the world. That was my pledge, and it's still going. I can't stop it. And the name, funny enough, of the event, I named it Swaporama. And then I thought, well, maybe we'll make it Rama-Rama for Ram. Right, Ram. So as it grew and I watched thousands and thousands of people take this event and celebrate it all over the world and send me videos and pictures, I was just like, every time they said the name, that second Rama, they were invoking Rama. You just don't go up against Rama. Rama is gonna work. Why use my will when I could use the will? It's the one's project. Right? I'm just a vessel. There's an interesting aspect about this that I've just come to learn, which is I could sit back and I could just be that girl who made that event forever and be like, oh, that's a perfectly good career, right? Like, I could just ride that. But if I do, if I stop asking for the new, how else can I serve? What else can I do? Then I also, it's like putting out the cup for Elijah on Passover, if you're in the Jewish tradition. You put a cup out for Elijah and you leave the door open on Passover, and you're inviting him to come. If I keep giving away the work I've done, I've created a space to ask for guidance again. But if I just sit back and I run that for the rest of my life, I'm just in a loop, doing the same thing again, 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 again. So I just gave it away, and then I wrote a book because it was the worst skill I had was writing. I was the worst writer ever. So I said, help me. And I wrote a book, and it's really good. People like it. So the point is, reciprocity. And if you're so inclined, hot potato. Thank you. Give it. Forget it. Walk away. Let guidance keep coming. There's a wonderful quote. I think I grabbed it. Ah. Murshid said of the will, the will. The will is the same. Our will, God's will, is the same will. We are in a unified reality. Whether it be human or divine, this is a paraphrase, whether it be human or divine, the only difference is that in one aspect it is the whole, in another a part. It's the same will. almighty and a certain might, tree and trunk, yeast bread. There is no reason for anyone to feel discouraged by weakness or deficiencies or by actions that have dissatisfied him or any failure. Begin to construct a mold of the future as you wish it to be, considering that the branch is not separate from the bough, the stem. We are not separate from the will of God. Begin to construct a mold of the future as you wish it to be, considering that the branch is not separate from the stem, the bough. We are not separate from the will of God. Forget your deficiencies and weaknesses. I was the worst writer ever. I was married to an editor, and I knew I was the worst writer. He would tell me, whatever you do, don't write. Right? Just like the doctor, whatever you do, don't run. Which brings us to another aspect of guidance, which is, how do we know when it's guidance? How do we know, right? So our practices as Sufis tune us, but we can say of guidance always, it's never going to be a pointed finger. It's never going to be judgment. It's never going to be harsh. It's never going to be your deficiency. It'll always feel like what you're given in guidance might seem like a burden to someone else, but to you it seems like, yeah, you know, like you have the total naivety to take on something enormous because it's actually yours. It's like when you hear the truth and you can almost say a bell went off, you know? We just know. And therein, you know, invites us to the part of our path which is trust and faith. We're really on the path of knowledge. We started this conversation with that. All we can do, if we're successful, all of you take away something from our being here this week that no one told you, right? It's like shooting arrows into the dark. God has to be a moving target. And yet, there are these ways that we can make it real and touch in and recognize. God will never have a pointed finger. Guidance will always feel like something, yeah, I want to do that. And then asking. You know, so often it's hard to ask. We don't feel we deserve, or, you know, if we're coming from a deficiency. There's a Sufi phrase, every sincere wish will be granted. Does anyone know the quote by Murshid about something, the success of the blessing is hidden in the consciousness of the blessing? Yeah, oh, I'll find it. Anyway, asking. So, so often guidance comes and we're so in our lives that we don't see it as guidance. And we want it to match up with what we want, very presumptuous, but I ask, you know, I want these things. So guidance comes and we just completely don't see it. Which is always the case, pretty much. So, and as we started, right, I am the guide, the guided, and guidance. Guidance is everywhere. We're the instrument that can tune to notice. So how do we live within this thing that guidance is happening all the time? We're constantly missing it, constantly, you know? We could, as Murshid said, or maybe this was even Muhammad, to accept the cup that's being offered and know that we actually have no idea how things are going to turn out. We don't have to wait to retrospect and go back and say, oh yeah, there was a gem, it helped me, it made me better, made me stronger. We can just, in the moment, whatever comes, say, surely this is guidance, because essentially there is nothing but. And I may not yet know how to see it, but yes. We know now, the psychologists of the world, that it's more important that we feel than that we feel good. So when we talk about accepting whatever cup is being passed, receptivity is actually letting ourselves feel what's happening. We don't know what's in it for us yet. It's presumptuous. We have these little narrow eyes, not the eyes. And there is that little swing back to faith, trust. Faith and trust are these tiny bridges in Sufism that lead us to knowing. Knowing is when the inner guide is clear and evident. But little bridges of faith and trust along the way. And, you know, if they don't go anywhere, well, then cut that bridge. There's other bridges. There's other things to do, to try. But along the way, and the trust grows. I mean, there's emergency we can realize happening every minute of every day, right? There's a million emergencies happening right now. When we are receptive to guidance and we get to know guidance, we know the emergency that's got our name on it, and suddenly, I'm sure we've all had a moment in our lives where you just get up and you're like, mine, and you just go respond. But how many do we see pass by and we don't do a thing? It's not that we're deficient emotionally. It's that if we're in guidance and we are tuned, when the thing that belongs to us appears, we are receptive enough, we've worked with our inner guidance enough, we know it to be ours. We know it's ours to stand up. So ways we can be receptive and come to know guidance in our own lives. There's a saying, God speaks to each person according to his or her degree of understanding. How many channels, how many bird feeders do you have out for the one? How many channels have you opened for guidance to come through? So what's a channel? It could really be anything. Anything that you bring your heart to becomes a channel. When my hip failed the second time, 15 years later, and they said, we're taking this hip again. And I said, oh no, let me work on this. Please, 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 please give me this hip. The doctor said, whatever you do, don't run. So I said, well, I'm gonna get out there and run because after this surgery, I'm not gonna be able to run. So I started running. Inner guidance said, run. Run, okay, can't run half a mile, but okay, started running. It's 3 years since that day now. First time in my life, I got an MRI and a doctor looked at it and said, you've got 25 years on this hip. Because running built so much muscle that I'm holding the bone out of the joint. Every doctor said, don't run. Impact, don't run, don't run. Inner guidance said, run. So now my channel, my promise, I won't waste this. And every time I step on the trail to run every other day, that's my church. Every time I feel pain, the pain is actually a gift. It's a reminder of my abundance, of my gift. It's not pain at all. And now running in nature is a channel, right? So what else could be a channel? Playing an instrument, drawing, contemplation, meditation, cooking, you name it. I mean, what are the things you love? What makes the thing you love a channel for divine communication, for being reached? As I think Rumi said, don't go anywhere without me. It's that we bring our presence to it. We can do it with our breath. Let's say I'm a cook. There is no, you know, this strawberry is a face of the one. I feed the mouths of the one in every form. I mean, we can bring it to anything. But how many channels in our lives have we made where we say, speak to me, meet me here? And of course, this has to come. This is our window of communication. There's another Sufi saying, what can I give to God? And the answer is your need. can we ask? Mercy. That's such a great word, right? Mercy.
Let's watch the time.
Does anyone know when we're supposed to end?
It's 12.
12:05? 12:10. Oh, good. Okay. I was hoping we could do another practice together. We'll have to skip a little, but... Oh, the other, you know, as embodied creatures, our main and most immediate and evident vessel for porousness, for dissolving boundaries, for guidance to reach us, is our senses. The Sufis often practice just vitalizing the senses, 10 minutes just hearing. Nothing else. Just sit for 10 minutes, just here. 10 minutes, just looking. Looking turns into seeing. Listening turns into hearing. When it's made a channel for the one to meet us. So, I was going to have a split in two and do this practice, but maybe let's just do it together, and we'll do it sort of popcorn style, where everybody can just kind of jump in and say something. I'll be the one person, and you guys be the other person. We'll split ourselves in two. So here's the question. Let's see. I think we can do this and make it work. If we try, this may be a tall order, we're going to try to let everybody answer and see if you can find an answer that's like one word, one or two words. So that means answering like without too much thought. Okay, so here's the question. We're just going to zip around. Now if it's too quick and you don't have something there, just it's okay. Just like let it keep moving. What prevents you from accepting guidance? Anything popping up?
Muddiness.
What fear. Prevents you from accepting guidance?
Fear. Blinders.
Say again?
Blinders.
What prevents you from accepting guidance? Say again?
Habit. Distraction.
Busyness.
What prevents you from accepting guidance? Even if you answer, just keep answering, because it'll change. What prevents you from accepting guidance? No, it's good. It's good. What prevents you from accepting guidance?
Distraction. Forgetting.
Remember to remember, the Sufis say. Hoshdardam. Remember to remember. What prevents you from accepting guidance?
Mine's the same. Fear of failure. Fear of success.
Forgetting. Yeah.
Fear of failure and success.
Self-imposed limitations.
Lack of faith that you can hear.
Trust, I hear in that.
Carelessness.
Alligators. He'll say, you know, you have all these ideas, and you say, you're up to your ass in alligators, so remember your idea was to drain the swamp.
Knowing how to discern your environment, what it is.
I hear again, trust. You know, we develop trust when we rely on the one, right? So if we stay in our safety zone, I'm comfortable in this range of things. If I stay in there, everything's really good. I'm like the master of the world, right? But as soon as I step over the line and I'm in this new turf, it's uncomfortable. And I have to go there, so I make elastic my boundary and make it bigger. For the one, there everything is included, nothing is outside. So la ilaha illallah turns the other way. Instead of no, this is not the real, it's yeah, this is, and this too, and this too, and this too, and this too. So if we step outside the boundary, and we're challenged and we have to grow to include it. We get used to it and then our boundary gets this big and I have a bigger field to operate in, and then it gets bigger still and bigger still, and with it comes trust. I keep putting out the Elijah's cup and something keeps coming through, and each time I question less, but the only way is reliance. I gotta step where there's no where to step.
Remembering the one.
And don't go anywhere without me. Don't go anywhere without me. I'll give you another very quick story because we're out of time. But so I learned that birth story that I told you when I was about 28, which is when I found out I was adopted.
Oh my God.
I knew I was in a body cast and I knew I had this trauma, but no one had that story. That story was absent. Something happened at birth, nobody knows, right? Then I find out I'm adopted and I find that story. So, but my point in this story is, talk about the gain and the loss. At first, finding that out was a shock. In retrospect, as a Sufi, there is no better exercise one can go through than to step off the safety zone into, I don't know who I am. I'm nobody. I've lost the entire identity that I have known myself to be completely, and stepped into negative space and just fallen. You know, you can't give a Sufi really a better exercise than this, because there's no cliff you can put me in front of that I will not jump off of now. You can't scare me. I own it. But it's that trust, you know, just that first step out into I have no idea. But then the second step is much easier. And the more times you step and the more times the ground is there to meet you, trust, faith is built on such things. I want to not miss our doing this practice because it's one of my favorites in the whole world. But I just want to first give you a lovely quote that I feel I can round off some of the things we've talked about. Accepting guidance is real. It means being witnessed, being helped, not being alone. Accepting guidance means letting go of poor me. I got a lot of juice out of that story. You know, the stories we tell, we're experts at, like, eliciting the emotive responses we wish to have from other people, right? We're like all little magicians. Think of the story you tell to a new person you just met. There's a lot in that story. As you go through life, sometimes you drop stories because they become no longer true. You reshape them with your heart. You can't tell the story anymore. It's not even true. It's like someone else's story. Poor me. So accepting that guidance is real is letting go of poor me. You might have to let a story go. It means having no excuse for not having a wonderful life. It means letting go of some of the burden you carry. It means letting yourself be carried. So, let's do a practice together. Oh, you know, I realize in retrospect, we didn't do the invocation. We were so disrupted by our move to this chapel. Well, we're going to have to do it twice. But let's do this practice. So this is one of my favorite practices in the whole world. The energy of it is like a battery. Okay, so there's two ends of a pole that are coming together in a part like this, like a battery, creating energy. So you're one end of the pole, and we say, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah. And as you say, Ya Allah, you hear back your own name on top. The two are overlapping. So I say, Ya Allah, but I'm hearing Jahanara. Ya Allah, Jahanara. And they're at the same time. Can you see what the practice is? The meaning of it? It's don't go anywhere without me. I'm calling out, I'm being called. And the two come closer and closer and maybe dissolve the boundary, maybe. This is the life work. So you can take this practice. What I love so much about it is you can take it on the road, you can walk with it, you can breathe with it, you can take it on your bicycle, you can take it anywhere. And no one knows you're doing it, and a meditator is never bored, right? This is, we are that which we seek. We can think about worrying about the stock market, or we can say, yeah, Allah, and hear our name called back to us. So maybe let's just do 7 of these together. And then you'll have it in your pocket forevermore. Put any emotive expression you want on this. It's your Ya Allah. It could be a whisper, you can scream it, whatever feels right. Ya Allah. Ya Allah. Ya Allah. Ya Allah. Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah. Let's do it 7 times silently in the heart. And the deepest level is to release the words and feel the quality of the space created by the practice. Amen. So before we end with Khatum, I wanted to give you a question, a contemplative question. So contemplative questions are so great because they last like a lifetime. You can ask it endlessly and it never runs out of steam. So a contemplative question: how does being aware of being guided change your feeling about bringing your gift to the world? How does being aware of being guided change your experience around bringing your gift to the world?
Can you say it one more time, please?
Yep. How does your being aware of being guided change your feeling about bringing your gift to the world? You know, if we are sitting in the position of being the one, we become the dust on the globe over the light of our soul when we refuse guidance and say, poor me, not here, I don't deserve. We become the dust. The light is already perfect, the light is already shining, but when we say, no, not here, poor me, as Pir Vilayat said, you know, our ignorance of who, what we are is the shield that covers over the soul. The soul's already perfect. So if you know the words to Khatum, O thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly comes from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness, teach us thy loving forgiveness, raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide us, send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being.
Still be working on this Aller tomorrow, so we will most likely be in here again tomorrow. As you're going to see Sacha.